Welcome to the AI Business Podcast, where we feature conversations with interesting guests at the intersection of artificial intelligence and business.
Hi, I'm Deborah Yao, editor of AI Business, and I'm very pleased to welcome Art Hu, the Global Chief Information Officer at Lenovo. He is also the Chief Technology and Delivery Officer of Lenovo Services and Solutions Group. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me, Deborah.
To start, can you tell our readers a little bit about what you do? You have whole dual roles at Lenovo.
Yes, absolutely. So I've been the Chief Information Officer for the company the last 7 years. And then in the last year, I have also become the Chief Technology and Delivery Officer for, as you said, our Services and Solutions Group, or SSG. In the IT role, this is about driving the company's transformation and digitalization. And in my newer role as the Technology and Delivery Officer for SSG, and that's really about building the delivery engine for services for the company, and then using technology to enhance the offerings that we're able to offer.
Well, wonderful. I'm sure like any big tech company that you use AI already, even before generative AI came on the scene like last November. At a high level, can you tell us about Lenovo's key investments in and initiatives around AI?
Yes, definitely. And as you said, AI, even before generative AI, is something Lenovo has been committed to for the better part of a decade. Right? This is something that we certainly saw coming early, and we've really developed and applied AI across our business. Right? When I review the breadth and depth of how we have integrated AI to help power our business, it's really become everywhere in the business. Right? I'm actually hard pressed to find any function or geography or region that's not using it. So that spans really our marketing, our sales, our customer services, our supply chain, and manufacturing. Right? And so that's the result of a very concerted effort over time to make sure we're getting the benefit in all the appropriate areas of the company. Now, specifically, more recently, we've committed to investing over $1 billion in the next 3 years so that we can accelerate both our internal AI deployment as well as enriching our own offerings that are going to be AI enabled and AI ready. And we know that's because that there's a lot of AI implementation. There's a lot of excitement there, but there's also a lot of noise that we need to help our customers simplify, especially as we're looking at new sources of data, new computing architectures that include not just the traditional client and cloud, but increasingly the edge, right? Woven together through sophisticated network solutions and with AI embedded. So right, that $1 billion is both for internal implementation as well as creating solutions and an AI-ready portfolio for our customers. Now, specifically now on the generative AI, as you said, that's really burst into the public consciousness in a very public way. In the last little more than half year or so, we've committed a further $100 million to develop the AI Innovators Program at Lenovo. And this is to tap into the very rich ecosystem of software partners that are working with Lenovo to deliver ready-to-deploy AI solutions across computer vision, prediction, security, and virtual assistants. So I think from our long-term commitment to AI, as well as to generative AI in particular, we're getting ourselves ready both internally and to power ourselves as well as externally and making these solutions available to our customers.
Can you give us a sense of the level of adoption or interest from your clients or customers on generative AI solutions?
Yes, I think right now it's certainly one of the hot topics. Right? When we look at our CIO research, AI and machine learning, and including generative AI, because it's so new, is really driving increased focus in this area. Right? And I would say it's actually absorbing a disproportionate level of attention, as well as the proof of concept or POCs that many companies are looking to do. And I think that's very natural because there's so much hype around it that everyone is exploring to see what's actually underneath the hype And so I expect for, we've both in the last half year, so for throughout 2023, and I expect it to continue. I do think this will be one of the topics that takes up a lot of the attention in executive discussions and even board discussions. When I meet CIOs in the industry, every single one is working with their business on identifying what is the portfolio of generative AI and how can it actually be impactful. Now, at the same time, as much as there is interest, I think CIOs are the ones that are charged with deploying it and creating value. And so I also hear customers that are a little bit nervous that people have exceedingly high expectations about what generative AI can do. And so there's also an aspect of deploying and harnessing part of that attention for education, right? Because what we don't want to do as an industry is have people have overly high expectations and then ultimately become disappointed. So we want to mitigate some of the highs and channel that into fully understanding the technology so that we can more quickly get on with the business of deploying it properly. At the end of the day, we should not make this, it is a technology, it is an exciting one, but ultimately it's still a tool that has its uses and it also has the areas where it may not work so well.
So can you walk me through a little bit of the conversation you or people under you have with customers in terms of kind of painting a practical picture of what generative AI can and cannot do?
Yes, and I think this one is actually playing into the strengths of CIOs and technologists around the industry. At its base, the generative AI is really going to be a prediction engine. Right? One of the analogies that seems to help business leaders grasp this quickly is that in its current form, it is a super autocomplete. Right? And that applies to a press release, that applies to a memo, it replies to an email response, it even applies to code, if we're talking about the large language models or the LLMs that, really with ChatGPT 3 and 3.5 have gotten, have generated so much excitement. And as such, I think people need to remember the fact that it is an incredibly powerful engine with a ton of coverage. And that's what makes the generative part seem very convincing. But once you understand that at the heart, it's really a probability engine that takes input that you give it and then generates what is likely to be output that it imagines that you want, then you can better understand it. And so in that context, you begin to see that when, for example, things that it may not be the best for is if you need an exact answer every time, right? If you are doing a very precise business analysis, right, around financial numbers or modeling, that you need to give a deterministic answer. It means, right, if I give it a certain set of outputs, I need another output exactly the same, then generative AI is inherently less suited for that because of its probabilistic nature versus being deterministic. Right? So that's one example. And another example would also be around giving it too much freedom for independent judgment. And because it has such an enormous breadth of input, it is, as we all know now, very convincing at having conversations and creating de novo or from scratch content for you. It, of course, has hallucinations, but really hallucinations are simply, it's not really a function of the algorithm. It's a function of the algorithm is creating something that is not having a real world analog. In other words, it's untrue, right? So it doesn't mean the algorithm is not working, right? That's exactly what generative AI does. But then the insight comes where the light switch goes off for business leaders who maybe they read a memo because it's quite possible for the large language models to output something that sounds very convincing and is entirely false. Right? And so that's the other light bulb moment for a lot of other business executives. And it's important for them to understand that's actually not, it's either a feature or a bug, but it's how the algorithm works. And so that from there, once you have those insights, you can begin to construct a better mental model for how to use this. Right? And maybe the final thing to round out this on a more technical point, but is equally important in discussions that we're having with our customers, is around the security. And this happens on a couple of levels. The first one is there have been multiple public incidents where inadvertently companies who were experimenting and maybe even informally among employees, they have leaked internal company information into the public domain. Because when you use a public and a publicly hosted large language model, then it's quite possible they are taking your input to further enhance and train and refine their algorithm. Unfortunately, when you do that, then whatever input you gave it, for example, if you said, "Hey, please help me complete this part of this section of code and this feature for my function," that then may go into the public domain. And so there's absolutely a protection of the company's intellectual property, especially around software and even proprietary information. For example, writing a press release that you really want embargoed until a certain date. But if it goes into the public domain, snippets of that might show up before you want it to. The other part of the discussion that's quite interesting and also quite meaningful is around the data sovereignty. Right? Many more of the regulatory regimes across the world are becoming much more specific about how they want to see data protected, right? How they want to see consumer data protected, how they want to see certain sensitive data treated. And so it's important because generative AI ingests a lot of data and it goes into this model that's a black box. Right? It's a very active field, but one that's not quite mature yet to understand why it is we get the outputs that we get from these very powerful models. And so there is the intersection of regulatory with technology that technology executives and the business teams who are using them need to be very cognizant of.
Well, wonderful. Given your comment that generative AI is probabilistic instead of deterministic, what kind of use cases do you think is it best suited for, given what you said?
Yes. So what we are seeing now, both in our internal proof of concepts, as well as what we see our customers experimenting with, really is around the assisting part. Maybe a bit of preface here is from how Lenovo approaches making technology solutions accessible to our customers. AI for us has always meant, and we've focused on AI as the augmented aspect rather than an artificial aspect. Right. We found artificial emphasizes the difference, right, and emphasizes the independence. And therefore, psychologically, it actually makes the change management and adoption by the business teams harder, right? When they think of it as the other, when they think of it as perhaps competition, when they think of it as perhaps something that would take over or replace humans. So that part, I think we've been very thoughtful and purposeful about communicating that really is augmented. I think you see Microsoft doing similar when they emphasize the co-pilot nature. Right? It is something that is with you as a way to augment what it is you're doing rather than replace you. So the augmentation aspect of using AI has been very important for us. And when we frame it that way, then it's really about helping accelerate tasks significantly, especially ones that would require content creation. So we see in the software engineering realm, the ability to improve the productivity in writing code, right? We see improvements in the ability to check if that code is accurate, as well as the test results. Right? We see in areas that require text generation, as a second example, that it's quite, right, and depending on your preference for style, but it's actually quite possible to have generative AI draft pieces of business communications, whatever that is, right? Internal memos, responses, even press releases, I've mentioned, and to be, right, depending on, it could be a very good first draft that then our teams are able to iterate more quickly, right? So those are very much in the assistive and augmented mode. Maybe just to give a third example, generative AI has also been very good around more nuanced and multi-layer intent understanding, right? And so in this realm of delivering services and being responsive to customers, it's a very potentially good way of improving customer experience. I think many of us as consumers have had the experience of a frustrating experience of a very simple chatbot where if you even put a letter, right, or a single word out of place or misspelled, it says, "Oh, I'm so sorry, Deborah, I don't know what it is you're talking about." The large language model powered chatbots we see are much more capable of having a human-like conversation, right, and understanding kind of multi-layer intent, right, that traditional chatbots that are based on kind of knowledge graphs and can are good for, you know, maybe just one round of a simple back and forth, are so that's an area where chatbots can be enhanced meaningfully. And that's important because I think from a services delivery perspective, the more that we're able to provide those experiences, then the better not only customers are going to feel, but the better cost to serve we have, right? So ultimately that provides better value for service in that equation as well. So maybe just I would use those three examples.
Given that you said that generative AI is not deterministic, does that mean that overall the impact of generative AI in transforming a company's operations is less than people are probably imagining right now?
I think that's to be determined, right? I'm not leaning either way. I think, again, it's just something to be aware of. We are just at the very beginning of understanding how generative AI would rewrite the operating manual, so to speak, for companies. And I think because it is able to do knowledge-intensive tasks, right, things that were pretty much out of reach of previous AI technologies, I think the jury is very much still out about that, right? Because operations, obviously, there's right, some aspects where, for example, a part is a part is a part, right? You don't want that one part to be a different part. You don't want it to be five parts, right? For us, we don't want three computers to turn into one computer in the systems. So there are absolutely aspects where it's, I would say, there are very good tools already that do that. And so, you know, might not be suited. But at the same time, one of the things going back to the ability to better understand intent, to better summarize, to better ingest or look over significant sums of data and identify trends, that's very powerful for operations management. Let me give you another example to illustrate. All companies run significant estates around computing and storage, whether that's in the form of on-premise, traditional data centers, private clouds, public clouds, or some mix of hybrid multi-cloud. Machines, so these servers and storage and networking devices are famous for generating a massive amount of data or telemetry coming off of them. Right? Alerts, updates, things that pass the threshold, that signal of an event of some interest might have happened. Changes in the machine operating state. And that's something that's already been quite powerful in helping companies manage those significant estates of computing effectively. Now, one of the things that we're always wrestling with is because there's so much data is how to make sense of that. And so I think it is very promising in the operations space for administering and managing the cloud, both public and private, to apply generative AI to understand and ingest the massive amounts of data that are coming off and then really find the trends that are happening. Right? How do you do the correlations? What events seem to be associated with stability? What kind of trends and underlying occurrences seem to be associated with incidents or customer service disruption? And so here I would say, Deborah, it's probably wise to take a segmented view, right? For things that are already working very well, that you know you need consistency and consistent outputs given a consistent set of inputs, right? There's no need to replace those tools because those are working already very well. I think where the opportunity is really elevating the focus to say, how do we turn the significant amount of data that's coming off and how do we get insights out of that that allow us to improve the operations at an even higher level. So I'm actually quite bullish about the potential opportunity in that space as an example. Right. So maybe just back to your question directly, right, there's some areas of operations where you don't necessarily need to use generative AI because we have perfectly fit for purpose solutions. But there are areas that are totally untapped that I think around understanding and correlating across large knowledge bodies and bases of data that we can take those data streams and use generative AI to extract and get much more insight that are going to be beneficial for improving and even redesigning operations.
So what would be your advice to other CIOs when they're looking at this wild west of generative AI applications, solutions, models, platforms? How do you make sense or organize all of that?
Yeah, so I think the first lens would be around the business, right? And I think here, if I look at how Lenovo for the better part of the past decade has been driving AI adoption appropriately into each part of our business, I think it's first important to make sure you bring the business in, right? Because they're the ones who are ultimately going to help you identify the high value cases and also provide the proving grounds to see what is or isn't working, right? So I think the flip side of that is making sure that you avoid the technology teams just doing a lot of POCs that are purely technical, but less grounded in what the business cares about. So that's probably point number one, which is bring the business in early. The second part I think we touched on earlier, which is really invest the time as well to help the business understand. And not just, right, so that they can have more meaningful conversations, right? You want to be able to land this with the business. So for example, I was just in front of one of our senior leadership forums, just showing demos, right? Not just in theory, but showing what software engineering augmented by generative AI looks like, showing how exactly we're applying this technology to improve our AI operations in the infrastructure management space, right? How exactly multi-level and nuanced intent identification leads to better experience. So I think I really can't understate as part of the business engagement, the need to keep the business educated, because then you make them much more powerful partners, right? Able to accelerate and say, yes, this works or it doesn't, and jointly identifying the things of interest. And then the third point, I think, is it is important to view this and understand this in the lens that it is early days, right? Even for my team, some teams committed very early and said, this is, right, the model we should use. But in fact, because it's so early, there are things that are changing every day, every week, right? If I look at, Deborah, you mentioned, of course, last November is when this really burst onto the public scene, right? Of course, OpenAI has been working for many years on this, but, you know, in the public consciousness, this has really been new. And so, with the introduction of the Llama model, for example, from Meta into the public domain, there are just so many experiments going on, and what is at the frontier of what's possible is advancing in a gratifying way. That's really fun to see, right? There are things that are happening around the ability to bring and compress large language models to become medium language models or even small language models that can fit either in the edge or even on a client device, right? A device that, like a phone or a computer, right? There are massive advances that are happening there, as well as in the strategies for making these large language models much more tailored to a specific context. And so on the technology side, I think it's absolutely important that IT teams and technology teams set up their architecture so that they're able to tap into the ecosystem, right? That they don't commit and say, oh, there's only one path forward, right? We're going to use only this technology going forward, because there's so much happening. I think everyone would benefit by keeping abreast of the various developments and having an architecture that's open and able to work with different models for different scenarios.
So when you're bringing in the business side to look at how you're going to deploy and implement AI, what kind of KPIs do you use? Do you use business KPIs? Do you use technical KPIs?
Yeah, so I think here, to the point that this is, I think it's important that we, as technologists, also stay well-grounded, meaning it is a technology, right? It's not going to be a magic wand that solves all your issues. And so I think the rule of thumb here is whatever KPIs, assuming that you have a healthy mix and that you have your internal best practices of what worked, whatever worked for companies in measuring outcomes of investments and enablements from the technology side, we should do, right? And those generally include, Deborah, both those things, right? I do think you still need to start with a business outcome, because otherwise you don't have a true north, right? Without a very crisp statement of the work to be done and the problem to be solved and the value that we are pursuing, then it's difficult. So for example, right, we would like to increase our customer NPS scores after working with the service desk by 5 points. Okay, well, that's very concrete, right? And it's very easy to understand. So there's that aspect. And at the same time, you do want the technical aspects, right? It is a technology. And so whether or not it is fit for purpose and performing up to the standards, there are absolutely a set of things around performance, right? Is it stable, right? Is it performing and consuming within the, is it consuming the target set of resources and not more and not less, right? Is it stable? Right? All those things are as well. There's actually something really interesting, I think, when you look at it as well, which is because Gen AI is so different in terms of capabilities and really being able to kind of assist humans with knowledge-based work, I do think there is this notion of understanding what is the budget, right? Like how much does it cost kind of the equivalent of an augmented machine helper? And I say that because one of the things that's not as fully appreciated is the potential costs of this. I think there's been a lot of press around how expensive it is to go actually build a new foundation model like Anthropic, like Llama, like ChatGPT, right? That it takes, right, however many thousands and thousands and thousands of GPU cores running for months, right, and to train, and millions of dollars of investment go into training. After it's trained, though, then the actual work of using them is, as you know, it's called inference, right? And so if you're talking to the bot, it has to run inference operations on this trained model. Now, inference operations are way, way cheaper than it costs to train the model. But especially for scenarios where there are many users in parallel, then inference can actually become quite expensive, right? So, even if it is an orders of magnitude less expensive to run a single inference operation, right? If you think about some of the industry scenarios, or even for a company, right? Let's take aside the large internet companies for a second. But if you just think about companies with consumer operations, it's quite possible you're going to have, thousands, maybe tens of thousands of people who are in your service network, right? Consumers who are trying to get an answer to a question. So in Lenovo's case, trying to figure out what's the latest driver to optimize the performance, right? How can they order and expand memory in their machine, right? How do they get help to get the most value out of something they've bought from us? When you add that up, that can actually be computationally quite expensive as well. And so I do think it's quite interesting in terms of metrics to make sure you kind of fully understand the implications of the technology that you're rolling out, because it could add up to considerable cost, right? We may not, we may actually have a time and say, hey, how much does it cost to kind of run the robot equivalent of this? And right, how does that compare with having a person do this? Right? I think it sounds silly because historically the implicit leading and assumption is, oh, of course, if a computer can do it, it will be cheaper. So depending on how the cost curve changes, right? And that's got a lot of inputs around algorithmic effectiveness and the future computing power and how many trillions of operations a second it can perform. But I think it is something for companies to monitor, because at scale, right, some of these operations can become material cost.
Do you think these parallel processing using inferencing, do you think that cost is going to come down over time?
Oh, absolutely. I think you can see in the industry, we're shifting from historically what's been CPU-centered compute, right, in our cloud data centers into something that's going to be much more mixed or heterogeneous. And I think you can see even in the roadmaps of the large silicon providers that they all are pursuing CPUs, GPUs, right, neural processing units, MPUs, right, data processing units, DPUs. So there's going to be an increasing specialization to tailor what kind of underlying hardware and computing is going to run this. And so, right, as these new specializations happen, as we have better architectures, as we have better interconnects, that's why I talk about kind of the evolving cost curve of this, right? Because it's, right, historically in tech, as soon as we have more power, then we find more ways to go use that. And so we're going to have this multidimensional game where algorithms are improving, increasing computing power, whatever form that takes, right? We'll call it XGPU for the second, just to avoid saying all those things again, or XPU, as well as right, new uses, right? I think all of those are going to continually reshape what the cost curve looks like. But in general, I do think that the curve will advance and we'll be able to deploy more computing, right, at a better price performance over time.
You know, I've heard there's an industry shortage in GPUs. Is that true?
Yes. So shortage is always a relative term, right? I think maybe it's better to think about it in terms of supply, demand, and lead times. And so if you look at the lead times for a lot of the specialized computing that people are looking for on the leading edge of this, that has certainly increased in the last year.
What do you think is the impact of Meta open sourcing Llama 2?
So this one, I mentioned that earlier, and I think if you look at just publications research on it, I think the open sourcing will, on balance, encourage more experimentation about what's open source, because suddenly, right, you had a kind of a more walled garden, and then you've then opened it up for more visitors to come in. And so what I've observed in the industry is that it's encouraged people, right? It's provided another place where people can focus their attention in this space to experiment, right? And so I think that's part of contributing to the accelerating, both interest as well as kind of discovery of new things and refinements that collectively should be good for this whole domain.
So one question, and then before we dive into what Lenovo is doing with AI. So can you give us a sense of how companies from different countries and regions view AI and generative AI? Are they as excited as people in North America and Europe? Can you give us a sense of that?
Yes, and I'll preface that by saying that the time I spend is, right, I spend a lot of time both in North America and Europe and Asia, and it's mostly from the perspective of business users, right? So I'll kind of target my comments there. It's a little bit more difficult for me to comment around global consumers in all the regions, but because we aim to serve because a lot of the time that I spend is around deploying technology for companies at scale, right? I think the business community globally, from the discussions I've had in the Americas, in Europe, right, and in Asia, I think are pretty uniformly interested, right? And they understand that generative AI is something that's going to be quite focused, right? And it's going to be quite impactful. And I think there's a general sense also that this really is a fundamental technology, right, that will continue to reshape how companies operate and maybe even reshape how jobs are structured, right? Because with all the augmentation, I think it really unlocks of new possibilities for how companies can use the technology to augment their workforce and their capabilities. So there's uniform excitement, right? And I think at this tempering that is also what we talked about, which is, well, how do we manage expectations properly so that this doesn't become, and we don't get into this disillusionment where the business says, all you technologists promised these wonderful things, right? You're promising Eden. And then actually what we got is just a little bit more, but better. So I think that we want to make sure, right, we don't get overexcited. And then it is very real around making sure that companies are able to comply and respect the various regulations and data protection laws that are really being specified around the world. And that part is particularly important for companies because it is an investment, right? Even within Lenovo, we're making active investments to restructure our architecture, right? So that we can have and respect the data sovereignty and the various compliance and regulations that are coming into place and being defined by government and regulatory authorities around the world.
So turning to Lenovo, can you share with us a use case using either generative AI or just AI in general within the company and also with one of your clients?
Yeah, absolutely. There's so many examples here, but I'll pick a quality example. Right. Meaning in the factories, one of the things historically has been around quality. Now, of course, and I'll take kind of two areas of this. Right. But so quality, one is, of course, inspection, and quality inspection historically has been very manual intensive, right? You kind of sample, or you have someone who's actually checking the output that's coming off of the line. And so because of its repetitive nature, this lent itself very well to both machine learning as well as computer vision, right? Because once you can take samples that are on the both the flip and the positive side, meaning you can take negative samples where there's free of any defects, so that's a good, and you tell the machine learning model to be able to pass those, as well as positive here, meaning it has a defect, and you say, well, we want to flag these for rework and to make sure those don't make their way into the hand of customers. So we've been very successful in actually using computer vision and machine learning models to automate our quality monitoring, right? And so that's actually also helped us reduce the costs to serve our consumers, because obviously if we can reduce customers getting defective products, right, that's going to be a significant positive impact to the experience as well as the cost, right? And the interesting thing is it also restructures the nature of work in a very good way, right? Rather than having, imagine someone, you're on a quality shift, you're looking just visually using your own eyes at an assembly line for 4 hours, right? It's really hard work, right, to stay focused on a single task for so long. And so by augmenting it with AI, right, we've been able to upgrade those skills and kind of restructure that job towards thinking about how to take the quality data, right, to do the job with the machine instead. So I think that's been a very positive impact. The other aspect is actually an example of closed loop, which is this is about making sure and ensuring quality at the end. It's a bit of a quality check. The other aspect of quality is actually you need to be able to design quality in from the start, right? Better to design your product for quality, I call it design to quality, rather than having to check at the end. Now, of course, you do both because you want to make sure that you're minimizing any defects. But what we can do, because of the significant amounts of data that are coming off our assembly lines, right? We're shipping many devices every second, right? That's Lenovo scale. And so it's so much data. We're also able to understand from the way we design what design points, what design choices are more likely to lead both to reliable products, easy to assemble without defect products, as well as products that are more complicated or more prone to assembly and manufacturing defects. And using machine learning on that stream of data, that becomes a valuable source of input for our design teams who are building the next generation of products. And so that's within Lenovo, how you can take data, apply AI, and actually use it to have multiple impacts, not in multiple parts of the company by getting insight from that. Now, with our customers, it's also something, and I'll use an example from the services space. The service desk, right? Service desk is one of the offerings that the solution, so SSG, the Solution and Services Group, offers to our customers. And we are currently enhancing our service desk to infuse that with generative AI. Right? And we've already seen in proofs of concept that we're trying out with our customers and also within Lenovo, that in fact it is leading to increases in both. Well, I think the direct impact is that it's leading to increases in understanding of the intent. So when you are actually having a query about trying to accomplish something, that the generative AI enhanced chatbots are able to grasp that. And then the follow-on effect is that it tends to make our internal users, as well as the customers that we're testing with, their customer satisfaction increases as well. Right, so there's a direct effect of better understanding, and then there's a follow-on effect where your overall satisfaction is higher because you feel you had the proper interaction to achieve your goal. Right? And so I think that's just that's kind of an internal example as well as external example. And the other thing here is, we do, because it's I talked earlier about the fast-changing nature, right? We have research and development labs. We have an AI lab, right? We've launched three data center labs in China, Europe, and the US to continue to help make sure we're sourcing ideas and we're kind of at the intersection of startups, new technology, and customers to be able to continue to introduce these into our products.
So tell me about some challenges you encountered deploying these proofs of concepts. And, you know, what advice would you pass along to other people in your shoes?
So I think on the proof of concept, again, scoping is important so that because you want, in terms of making sure you want to have a proper scope. Right? In other words, you don't want to bite off more than you can chew. It's important that proof of concepts deliver something quickly so that you can take advantage of the time you're harnessing the business attention. Right? When people, if you have a proof of concept that drags on for a half year or 9 months without a clear output, it's easy for the business to lose interest. So, right, one very practical thing is we've had to time bound, right? That's one of the things is, okay, if we're going to do a proof of concept, let's just pick a timeline that's within a quarter, whether that's 2 months or 6 weeks, but to really force the pace to say, let's have something that shows this could be useful with a preliminary result, one way or the other. Right? So I think making it very time bound has been helpful to keep people interested and focused in the proper way. The second part is also, again, tying back to understanding what the limits of the technology are. Right. So for example, there are some issues that generative AI can't fix. Right. And so in order to have a good proof of concept, you want to spend time making sure you also have the prerequisites. So for example, right, in some parts of our POCs around improving our service desk, right, we found that part of the reason we weren't getting the ideal results was we needed to enhance some of our underlying knowledge base, right? In terms of bringing the right context and part of bringing the right history into the discussion so that the model could be properly tuned. Because you can train a chatbot all you want, but if it doesn't have fundamentally the domain-specific knowledge that it has to meaningfully engage with the users, you're not going to get the right outcome. So I think it's important to check when you're thinking about not just the scope, but do you also have the other ingredients that are necessary? And like I said, it's also possible for technology is a tool. Right? It definitely suffers from a garbage in, garbage out phenomenon. Right? So meaning you have to make sure you're giving, in this context, the right domain-specific knowledge for the scenario you're looking to accomplish.
So on the flip side of this is, what are some common mistakes that you've seen?
Yeah, so I think common mistakes would really, it would be a mirror of some of what we talked about, right? If you pick something where you are just going into exploration mode. So maybe to be very concise about this, one is you become unmoored or divorced from the business, right? You just start investigating technology and you spend all your time trying to tell, just in the technology, but without a focus point or a focal point towards a business scenario, right? The other point is in communicating it, and I've seen is that people perhaps get overexcited about the technology, right, and they don't build the bridge so that you can help the business walk across it, right? So, right, if you're a techie and you're really into the details of this, then you're really interested in the new tech stack, right? What are exactly the latest advances? How exactly are we compressing algorithms? What's the coolest vector database that you can use for embeddings? And I've seen technologists get so excited. And there's a lot going on, and it is genuinely exciting. I've seen technologists get a little bit lose the plot with the business, right? Because then the business, if they don't have those bridges to be able to hook in and understand what the meaning of that technology is, I think that's also important. Right? And then the third, as I said, is getting too hung up on any particular solution, right? I think teams need to be prepared to experiment and to figure out over time how to evolve their solutions if they want to continue to take advantage of these innovations and these new developments as they're happening so quickly.
Given that there's a lot of exciting generative AI tools out there, how do you tackle the problem of shadow IT?
Yeah, so if by shadow IT, I philosophically also, I think it has been, from my management perspective, I think it's important to reframe that a little bit, right? And the way I try to think about shadow IT is, and maybe Deborah, just to clarify, for shadow IT, I think you mean IT that's done by the business that's not as governed, right? And that's really driven by the business rather than by a central technology organization, correct?
It would be, you know, them devs just using any tools without telling management and just deploying it.
Yep. Yes, exactly. So I think first and foremost, this is one about customer empathy. I don't think it's not specific to generative AI, right? But I will talk about why I think it's even more important that CIOs and technology executives can help get their hands around this. I like to think of this really as a signal, right? Whenever you have the business doing something, perhaps outside the governance, I interpret it as a signal that they have some kind of need that is not being met. Right? Because if they could just come to you and say, do it, and you could meet their requirements, then why would they spend extra effort? Because their primary focus and KPIs are on driving the business, not the technology. And so once you view shadow IT in that perspective, I think that then it's much easier to start inviting the business in and to, at a minimum, at least get the governance in place so that you can understand what are the various pieces that are happening. I do think it's particularly important with generative AI because there's a lot of data, right? And then the risks we talked about leaking data, or right, about compliance issues, become extra important. And so, right, I don't think generative AI causes shadow IT, right? I think it's, but certainly I can see businesses wanting to experiment with themselves. And so to tackle this, I think it's, again, to interpret this as, they want something that the technology teams aren't meeting. And then secondly, specifically for generative AI, I think it is important to get a company-wide kind of guidance or guardrails, depending on how you frame it, so that everyone, even if they want to experiment, that they're able to do so safely. And what I've seen is once the business sees that you're not trying to squash them or prevent them from doing things, then that you really want to balance how to protect the company with helping the business innovate and move forward, then they're much more willing to have the discussion. Right? And I think as a technology executive, it is important to be able to, in some sense, kind of seed, right? But really understand that you're going to have to delegate and have some virtual governance, because it's impossible at big companies that every single thing is going to pass by your desk. It is an opportunity because of the attention, though, to help educate the business on what's the right way on how they can do business-driven technology innovation and still fit within the corporate governance that's meant to both empower and protect them.
So switching gears a bit, I want to talk about Lenovo Research and also what things you're working on, as well as any partnerships you may have with other research institutions.
So on the research side, I think first it's important to clarify that one of our focus areas in the research space is to create the domain-specific models. Right? A lot of what people have heard about publicly is kind of these general models that are good for consumers. But in business settings, right, there are so many. Each industry is so specific, and there are massive amounts of knowledge and data that we can reason over. The next frontier for businesses absolutely will be how can we take the underlying technology but make industry-specific or even customer-specific or use case-specific, right? Depending on how deep the knowledge base is, to go apply. Because we see that when we're able to do that successfully, you get much better results for the task at hand, right? So in terms of research, I think there's a lot of work to be done on how do we take these general foundation models and make them much more specific and also smaller. I think you can think of it as in two dimensions. One is adding industry-specific and domain-specific knowledge. And then the second one is making them smaller so that we can make them much more applicable. If you think about Lenovo, we offer the industry's most comprehensive kind of client, right, edge, server, storage devices portfolio. But as you know, some of the largest models, they are too big to run on anything but the cloud or some really large computing devices. As we make advances to make them smaller, then it really democratizes the technology, because then you can start thinking, well, maybe I don't need, right, an 8-way server or a huge rack to go run this. Maybe I can run it on a smaller light edge server. Right? If we make it even better and as computing gets even better, maybe we can put it on a PC. Right? Maybe we can put some version of it on a phone. So, right. One is domain specificity. The other direction is around democratization. by advancing the state of the art around how we can compress them while still getting good performance in terms of the accuracy out of them. And we continue to partner, right? So in the supply chain, right, there's a company called we work with called Vistry, V-I-S-T-R-Y, right? And it's around how we can work with these restaurants to use computer vision to help on cook times and to improve supply quantity forecasting to prevent food waste, right? We work with a company called Deep Brain on an end-to-end solution for virtual assistants with the help of large language models in hospitality and retail. So I think Tesh and the team can get you some more of these examples. But yes, so absolutely within research, right? Like I said, both across more industries and towards democratization. And we tap into the ecosystem because there's just so much company. I think if I looked at the venture capital investments, I think even earlier this year, it was already in the first quarter, double what the amount was last year. And so I think we're going to see a lot more coming online in terms of entrepreneurs who have bright ideas about serving businesses that we can partner with.
Well, wonderful. And I want to ask you a question that's been bugging the AI community, actually globally. Where do you stand in terms of AI being an existential threat to humanity?
This one is probably beyond what I think, you know, as a CIO and CTO, that's not something, right, that's normally within the business scope, right? But I think philosophically, I would go back to how we do approach it, which is I think we focus on the augmentation, right? And I would say, right, while, you know, foundation models and large language models are absolutely a huge leap forward in terms of capability, kind of the science fiction AGM, right? Artificial general intelligence that basically is kind of you or my brain in a box. I think that's still quite far away. I think humanity has enough challenges on its plates to focus on, right? And if we use and continue to use the current technology in terms of augmenting, I still think there's a lot to go and a lot of runway to go before we start worrying about some of the more existential questions.
Well, thank you so much. Do you have any final thoughts to share with our listeners?
No, this has been a great discussion, Deborah. I think you've been very thoughtful with your questions, and I think I've enjoyed the discussion.
Thank you so much, Art, for joining us today.
Thank you again, Deborah.
To get more AI news and insights, visit our website at aibusiness.com. Until next time, thank you for listening.